Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our lunchtime talk today with Professor Michael Byers, who fittingly holds the Canada Research Chair in Global Politics and International Law, having made a long journey from McGill, Saskatchewan, Cambridge, Oxford, Duke to British Columbia. Quite a voyage. One of the interesting things about Michael is that he seems to be usually a step or two ahead of the curve, which is finger on the pulse of the zeitgeist, one might say. He started to write about interdisciplinarity before anyone else did, books on power and custom, which was the PhD prepared here, if I'm not mistaken, edited volume on the role of international law, or the role of law in international politics, which is probably one of the more successful edited volumes ever. Just before the turn to historiography, is that the right word, took off, he translated the monumental Epochen der Völkerrechtsgeschichte from German, from Wilhelm Grewe's work, to English. He is the author of what I think is still the sole monograph on the international law of the Arctic, and recently, 2-3 years ago, published a book on what is now becoming a hot topic, the law of outer space. Who owns outer space? You'll be talking about, tantalizingly perhaps, the secret life of legal advisors, and I'm told that's part of a longer project as well. Michael, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Jan. I've just set my timer to 30 minutes because the most valuable part of any gathering like this is the discussion at the end of the talk. I have to say that this place, the Lauterpacht Center, means a lot to me. I used to come here every Friday, a little bit early, to eat as many sandwiches as possible. I spent 4 years as a PhD student in the law faculty here at Cambridge, and I've had a lot of good years in my life, but those four really do stand out. For those of you in the room who are in the privileged position of being graduate students right now, burn the candle at both ends, right? You are in the right place for that, and you will never regret the both ends of that candle. Don't spend too much time in the square. So I'm going to tell you about a project that actually began in terms of the intellectual work during my time at Cambridge, but also the 2 years immediately before that. In 1991 and 1992, I had the wonderful experience of being the most junior lawyer in the Canadian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And I had a good boss who made my life interesting. And I could tell a lot of stories about that period. I want to tell you just two. One was attending an interdepartmental meeting in preparation for negotiations at the United Nations on something that people were thinking would become a declaration on the rights of Indigenous peoples. And so I showed up at this meeting with 8 or 10 other lawyers, all of them much more experienced than I was. And one of them said, you all know that Canada's standard approach going into any international delegation is to arrive on the first day with our own draft, which we share with everyone else. And I was looking a little bit puzzled. I was young and naive. And he looked at me and said, well, if you can set the agenda, you're halfway to the conclusion you want. And so a lot of time was put in. This was at the end of a heyday of Canadian legal diplomacy that started in the 1960s and continued through the late 1990s, the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court, the Landmines Convention. But it was an admission of a strategy that the lawyers were just
telling their client what the law was. The lawyers were engaged in lawmaking, but then they were also trying to advance their country's interests by doing certain things, like setting the agenda. Incidentally, just as an aside, one of the things they wanted to do in setting the agenda was to make sure that there was no S on people. So it would be the draft Declaration on the Right of Indigenous People, i.e. individuals. They lost that one. The declaration recognizes group rights, which I gather initially was why there were four abstentions on the declaration. Canada, the United States, Australia, and New Zealand. But not all strategies succeed. The following early summer, my boss, a wonderful man named Robert Haig, Bob Haig, called me into his office and said, I've just received a really interesting document. It's a big, thick document. He said, it's an internal legal opinion from the U.S. State Department. And, well, I don't trust the Americans. So I want you to, you know, read it carefully, think about it, and come back and tell me tomorrow whether it's, you know, a good document or if there's something wrong with it. And his instincts were correct. There was something wrong with it. The issue dealt with in this internal legal opinion that had been leaked to all the foreign embassies in Washington. The issue at the heart of this was whether or not the Geneva Convention relating to to refugees, 1951, a refugee convention, whether it applied on the high seas, whether the obligation of non refoulement, obligation not to return someone to persecution, applied in international waters. And this was not a settled issue in 1951. The U.S. Coast Guard had just started to return tens of thousands of Haitian migrants who were fleeing for the safety of Florida from chaos in Haiti. And the U.S. Coast Guard was picking them up and taking them straight back to Haiti. And so I read this legal opinion and I realized that the State Department lawyers had engaged in a little sleight of hand. Some of you will know about the customary international law rules on treaty interpretation set out in the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties. We have, I think, the world's leading expert on this in the room. The State Department lawyers went straight to the travel preparatoire, straight to the negotiating documents. They did not engage in a 31-1 analysis concerning the ordinary meaning of the terms, nothing about the context or the object or the purpose of the treaty. Didn't even look at subsequent practice, went straight to the travaux. And lo and behold, well, guess what? In 1951, they weren't thinking about the high seas because they were drafting the refugee convention in the context of people fleeing the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe for the democracies in the West. And I showed my boss this, and he said, yeah. He said, I'm not surprised. I want you to write your own legal opinion. And if it's good enough, we'll send it to the embassy in Washington. I've never worked harder. In a week, I wrote this opinion. I did it proper, like textbook, tree interpretation, came to the opposite conclusion from the State Department, had it vetted and improved by half a dozen of my more senior colleagues, and off it was sent, and the Canadian ambassador in Washington took it to the State Department. I was not at that meeting, so I don't know for sure what happened. But it is possible that the Canadian ambassador was told that if this is the position that Canada wants to take,
on international law, well, perhaps you'd like to take 100,000 Haitians.
And within 1 week, a Canadian naval frigate was assisting the U.S. Coast Guard in returning boat people to Haiti.
As I said, this internal document was leaked to all of the foreign embassies in Washington. Not one country objected to the legality of the U.S. actions with regards to the Haitian boat people. There was a very principled, very comprehensive objection from the United Nations High Commissioner on Refugees. Now, I don't know if that moment was decisive. I'm not a refugee lawyer, but I do know that many states today feel confident in the legality of intercepting migrants on the high seas and not granting them refugee determination procedures. So the U.S., as I least understood at the time, had written a deliberately misleading legal opinion, pretended that it was an internal document, which therefore reflected what they really thought, and then leaked it to all the other governments. And if any of those governments objected, they would have been subject to the kind of pressure that Canada was. So it was a combination of lawyering aimed at propagating a certain interpretation of a treaty with a view, presumably, to generating subsequent practice and a change in what might have been the general interpretation beforehand. So there you go. I arrive in Cambridge. And in early 1993, back when the seminars were still held in the library, before this room was built, the guest speaker was a man named Hans Corral, who at the time was the legal advisor to the United Nations. And was speaking about a plan to put a draft resolution before the Security Council to create the International Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. And it was quite literally just 1 week, you know, ahead of the actual vote that he was here speaking about. And I was a young, naive, academically minded international lawyer. And I said, are you sure that's the right approach? Because a Security Council resolution creating an international tribunal isn't going to have as much legitimacy as a treaty-based tribunal, right? And wouldn't it be good to actually get ratifications from the countries in the region that are affected by this? This is during the, you know, the breakup anyway, you get the point. He looked at me, he said, no, he said, there's an imperative for speed here. I have the five permanent members on board. We need to act. This is not just about justice. This is about the political statement of the international community acting quickly. And then he looked at me, I still remember Dover's glasses. He said, but just so you know, I'm also of the view that if we create this tribunal through the Security Council, and it is effective and seen to be fair, that will pave the way towards a permanent treaty-based international court with global reach. So he was also thinking strategically. And having arrived at Cambridge, I was encouraged by my supervisor, James Crawford, who, when he learned of this developing interest, said, well, you need to do some more case studies. So I wrote a draft chapter on the Truman Proclamation on the Continental Shelf, 1945, and found internal documentation within the U.S. State Department with regards to the making of the claim
the making of the claim that the United States had rights to the resources on the continental shelf off of its coastline in a way that would be reciprocally available to every other coastal state in the world. And that this was done according to the internal documentation in the State Department with the views to securing widespread acceptance of the U.S. claim and turning it into customary international law. It only took 13 years for coastal state rights over the resources of the continental shelf to be set out in the 1958 convention, the Geneva Convention on the Continental Shelf. The framing of the claim was done strategically in order to advance the interests of the United States through securing the acceptance of others and turning a claim into law. Another case study on the development of the prohibition on torture, where the focus initially was on getting the United Nations General Assembly declaration with the intention of going back and turning it into a treaty, which was done 4 years later. So taking the small step of a declaration to create momentum to get to a treaty. I did a case study on the standard of compensation required for the nationalization of assets owned by a foreign company within a country's territory. I learned about the Calvo Clause and the Hull Doctrine. I learned how the states of what we now call the Global South formed a collective bargaining unit called the G77, which they combine with their having achieved a majority of the votes in the UN General Assembly to start to adopt UN General Assembly resolutions, rejecting the Hull Doctrine of prompt, adequate, and effective compensation with a self-judging level of compensation on the part of the sovereign state that was doing the expropriating. And then what was most interesting was the response of the United States and its partners in the North, in the developed states, in shifting to a strategy of bilateral investment treaties. It's what people like A.L. Benvenisti now call serial bilateralism. It's basic game theory. It's the prisoner's dilemma. And so having lost in the multilateral forum, the United States then proceeded to go one by one to these small, poor states and insist on a bilateral negotiation in which, taking advantage of the power differential and the lack of coordination with other countries, they were able to secure 5,000 times in a row acceptance of the Hull formula in these BITs. Again, entirely strategic, entirely intentional. So I wrote a book about the customary international law aspect of this called Custom, Power, and the Power of Rules, which was my PhD thesis. And thanks to Finola O'Sullivan, who's here today, became my first Cambridge University Press book. But in the course of writing that book on custom and power, I acquired like literally another 100 examples of strategies being applied across international law. So the second book was going to be a book on that broader range of strategies. And between the thesis in 1996 and 2004, over the course of 8 years, I interviewed more than 100 legal advisors in foreign ministries and international organizations, and also several lawyers from mega corporations, trying to not understand what they do in terms of what they're, you know, what they eat for breakfast, how they dress, how they organize their offices. I mean, there are lots and lots of books on how legal advisors organize their offices. I was interested in the tricks that they play, the strategies that they have, the things that legal advisors do not write in chapters in academic books after they retire. If you're a poker player, you don't show your cards, right? And some countries have playbooks, have institutional memory as to the strategies that have been applied in the past and can be applied in the future. And they instill in their young diplomat lawyers this knowledge. Now, the very best country at this has been the United States of America. And I had the privilege more than 2 decades ago now of interviewing William Taft IV, who was the State Department legal advisor. At that time, this was around 2000, and would have been around 2003. And very quickly realized that none of this was accidental, that the Taft and the 700 international lawyers working in the U.S. government knew exactly what they were doing in terms of deploying a multitude of strategies against other countries. And the most obvious one is that you try to disadvantage the other countries in the negotiations. So bilateral investment treaties, that's one approach to disadvantaging other countries. But in a multilateral negotiation context, it's to set up as many negotiation tracks as possible. So if you have 20 different negotiating tracks within a large multilateral negotiation, well, the country that has only one international lawyer to send to the negotiations has to choose which of the 20 tracks he or she goes to, right? And of course, they set the agenda. They come in with the drafts. And it goes on and on and on. And so the book, the title of the book, very quickly became The Secret Life of the Legal Advisor. And the subtitle is Strategies of International Lawmaking. And then in 2004, life intervened. A family medical challenge that required most of my attention for the next 15 years, which is fine. I was still able to have a very happy professional life, but I wasn't able to write the big book. And that situation changed about 5 years ago. And I went back to the manuscript that I'd written, 127,000 words. And I was, despite the fact it was in a really, really old software, I managed to recapture it and reformat it again. And I read it and I went, yeah, there's something here. And so I spent a chunk of my time over the last 4 years, and this is putting me in a really interesting position. At least I find it a really interesting position because I have a much more, what's the word? My perspective is now two perspectives in one book. There's the perspective of the young academic in around 2000 and the perspective of a much more senior academic 30 years later. And with that, all of the, not just the things that have occurred during that period, the opportunity to update in terms of examples, update in terms of literature, but also to pull in the things that I've learned, because I have been busy during that period. I wrote a book on the Arctic. I wrote a book on outer space. I've been involved in quite a number of state-to-state mediations in concerning international law and international lawmaking, and so it's going to be a young Michael Byers and old Michael Byers. Maybe it should be Michael Byers and Michael Byers, The Secret Life of the Legal Advisor. But the Cambridge University Press Syndicate approved the book last week, and I set a deadline of December 31st of this year. So there's a lot of work to be done. But I'm also talking about it now, because audiences like this have their own experience. And this includes all the young people who are working in specific areas who are coming across what might be strategies, right? That might be examples. And it's also an opportunity for us to have a discussion about how different states play this game, how less powerful states can engage in blocking strategies or coalition strategies, and how rising superpowers like China are beginning to play this game. I'll be completely honest, even though I'm being taped, I have a personal ideological reason for writing this book. I don't like the fact that all these strategies are secret, because most of them are deployed most of the time by the powerful states. These are things that make the powerful even more powerful in international lawmaking. And I would like to level the playing field just a little bit by exposing the games, the tricks that powerful countries play. Ernst Ulrich Petersmann says I should call my book with a subtitle, A Recipe for International Lawmaking. That's not the point. And the point is that there are strategies being played, and everyone who might be subjected to these strategies should have the opportunity to recognize them. So there is an ideological reason, but it's also driven in very significant part by the fact that there is no literature that looks at this form of activity across the board. There are lots of pieces of literature that look at discrete strategies. Right? So there's a literature on the package deal, right, which is a strategy. There's a literature on how the United States broke out of the package deal with the 1994 changes to Part 11 of UNCLOS. And I've written half a chapter about that game that was played in two directions. There's also, sorry, while I mention it, there was a Canadian strategy at play in UNCLOS, in that it was clear, at least to Canada, before the negotiations started, that the really difficult issues would be negotiated between just two states, the United States and the Soviet Union. And Canada would not be in the room unless Canada found a way to get into the room. So Canada lobbied really hard and offered to provide at no cost the full attention of one of their very best international lawyers. Alan Beasley was selected as the chair of the drafting committee of UNCLOS. What does the chair of the drafting committee get to do?
Set the agenda.
Why Canada loves UNCLOS. Article 234, the Arctic exception. Thank you very much. We'll take that. Article 76 on extended continental shelves. We have the longest coastline of any country in the world. Yep, we'll take that, right? I mean, there are Canadian fingerprints all over UNCLOS, and that's because a non-powerful country, a middle power, had the man with the pen in the room. That's a strategy. So the fact that people have written about discrete strategies, the package deal being one example, or the use of soft law as a strategy, it is valuable for me. But it's also, I think, an opportunity and a challenge to explain the big picture. And the thing you need to realize here, and this is why I'm so interested in the senior people in the legal offices at foreign ministries and at international organizations, is they're the only ones who really see the big picture. And it's the combination of diplomatic and legal experience serving their government internationally that makes them, in terms of what they do with regards to lawmaking, a very interesting and I think important part of the body of law that we all study. And law is not just words on paper. The law is living, but it's living in a way that is constantly influenced by human action, by initiatives, by objections, by the somewhat controlled turmoil of international affairs. And the people who ride that wave and actually make things happen are the legal advisors. And they will never tell you about it, because these are their cards in this game of poker. So I'm going to flush them out of the closet so that we can all look at them closely and learn more about international law at a time where most people would think international law is, you know, under some stress. And I hope someone asks me a question about that. Well, that's 28 minutes. That's enough of me. Questions, comments, please.